Okay, we're moving on to the second presentation by London Economics. Should be on your screens for those who are on offline or online.
So today, Julia Freyre is going to present on behalf of London Economics. Hopefully that'll help us condense the time a little bit. Then during the question and answer session, Julia and I will both be available for questions.
And on the agenda as well, there will be a short presentation after our presentation from George Fitzpatrick as well, focused on a very specific subtopic related to nuclear performance. Good morning, almost good afternoon to you all. I would like to thank the opportunity to be here today, with that in mind, tell you a little bit about why we're here, and I hope I can figure out how to use this. Ah, it works, except I don't think you guys can see it. We're on slide two. Just setting it up so nothing's cut off. London Economics was retained as an independent expert on IRA matters by Ontario Power Generation. Our experience on these matters goes back quite a ways. AJ and I, to highlight a little bit, have had the opportunity to talk about IRA issues here in Ontario. AJ previously provided expert testimony on this exact topic, OPG's generation assets for the Ontario Energy Board, and I've testified as well on third-generation IRM matters for distribution utilities. We've also testified in PBR proceedings in other jurisdictions, and most recently in Alberta. Last and foremost, I won't go through the whole list, I presented at CANPUT last year on performance-based rate-making principles at the invitation of the Canadian Electricity Association. And the presentation today that we've prepared is composed of three parts. What I'd like to start with is a really brief discussion of the core elements of IRM, and then go through a summary of what I believe is the status quo, kind of the basic facts, if you will, regarding regulation of OPG's prescribed assets. And finally, I'll go through a review, our review of the Power Advisory Report. Really, we were keyed off of providing feedback and critique of the PA report, and developed our own independent recommendations on the basis of that report. I have included several appendices here as well that are quite detailed in terms of responding and giving our feedback on specific options documented in the Power Advisory Report. I will not go through that today. I think that will take much longer than the time we've got allotted, but we've included it in the written copy that will be posted, I understand, on the board's website. So with that in mind, keep hitting the wrong number. Ontario, as we all know, has had quite a lengthy history, more than 10 years now, in applying price caps. But that's been limited in terms of its application under electricity distribution and gas distribution utilities. It's important to recognize that IRM is evolving even for those two sectors. And I would like to say that IRM, and it's known as performance-based rate-making or PBR in other jurisdictions, is generally an evolution, not a revolution in regulatory rate-making. In that regard, and the last bullet point on this slide kind of addresses that, I like to say that cost of service rate making principles aren't lost once there's a transition to IRM. Cost of service rate making principles are, in fact, I think in the words of the Power Advisory Report, an important starting point or cast off point for consideration of a PBR scheme or an IRM scheme. I personally found that the model framework that the board staff created for the straw man released in February to be quite encouraging in being able to identify objectives, current practices, and options for the future. And this is also, I think, part of the background that I bring to thinking about IRM and its potential applications and options for OPG. And this is why I said earlier that IRM is not a revolution, it's an evolution. We do expect that there will be adjustments made over time, and we've seen that successfully done as well in other jurisdictions like the United Kingdom, where the concept of price caps and PBR has been applied for more than two decades at this point and has gone through various stages of development over time. The last point, graphical point on this slide, is really a foundational point for me. And I thought it's useful as a way of a reminder that IRM isn't necessarily limited to the concept of a price cap, although we are most familiar in application with price caps in Ontario. I think it's important to keep in mind that there are many different flavors of incentive regulation, and the concept of a regulatory lag or rate freeze, firm cost of service, performance standards, earnings sharing mechanisms, and price or revenue caps. And to some degree, these different flavors can be combined together. They don't need to be mutually exclusive in application in creating an incentive rate making regime. In the context of price cap regimes, I think an important takeaway is that there are, I think, two foundational approaches by those that set price caps. And we've got a lot of familiarity here in Ontario with total factor productivity, which is a method by which the X factor is set. And I know there's been a bit of discussions from Power Advisory earlier this morning about the difficulties and challenges I've personally experienced here at the board of setting the X factor and working through the empirics. There's also something called the building blocks approach. That's the nomenclature I give it. It is a form of a price cap approach, and it's the form that's currently in use and has been historically in use in the UK and Australia. It is still a price cap ultimately, but the big difference is in terms of how the productivity determinations are applied, how they're determined. The building blocks approach still employs productivity targets as part of the analysis, but in effect, it approaches it at a more bottom-up perspective, where it's studying effectively productivity targets for various cost centers, potentially performance targets as well, and there's a build-up, if you will, of a forecast revenue requirement. And ultimately, the X factor that's derived to track that forecast revenue requirement for the price cap is not only a combination of the overall productivity expectations, but also effectively a glide path. So there's a smoothing element to it, too, over the period of the price cap. There's a general consensus from the academia and the empirical world that the theoretical foundations for price cap regimes, and specifically, I think, total factor productivity approaches to price cap regimes, incorporates a number of prerequisites. And one of those is that the regulated utility is operating in a steady state environment steady state operating conditions. Therefore, the long-run historical dynamics are appropriate to apply on a forward-looking rate-setting mechanism basis. With a building blocks approach, that same prerequisite isn't as strong, and in the sense that it within the building blocks construct, one could actually incorporate how different the future is from the past. By making very clear considerations on OPEX, on CAPEX, on future output and production, how those differences arise. With that regard, I think it has been recognized that the building block approach is one of the the building blocks approach to be able to be adaptable to conditions as they change in the future. It has been one of, I guess, its successes that has allowed for that type of approach to be maintained within the UK regulatory framework for so long. I spent a lot of time on this because I think to some degree I wanted the vocabulary to be understood. I will come back and use this concept of building block approach throughout the presentation. Last slide, I hope, on best practices. I start off on this slide talking a little bit about considerations and resolution to considerations of a number of factors. In order for a price cap regime to be successful, in my opinion, it needs to incorporate a very pragmatic as well as a robust theoretical consideration of issues. The pragmatism comes in terms of best practices, and there are, as you can see in my first bullet point, a number of questions that need to be answered. There is no single set of solutions, in my experience, that I've identified as answers to these factors. I think that one-size-fits-all concept is likely to create unintended consequences. So one must go through the exercise of looking at these questions and thinking through answers by review of the industry, the context, the data. I have not provided answers to these questions because I think it's premature at this point, but I think it's important for us to all understand that these are the types of questions we must ask each other as we go to the next step of actually selecting a mechanism and working through potential parameter values. The second and I think guiding point for me when I work on performance-based rate making IRA mechanisms is to keep in mind that although it's very attractive for us to look at the IRM formula and look at each of the parameters individually and sequentially and come up with a value or a parameter choice for the inflation factor and then go through and look at the X factor and come up with empirical studies that determine what that is and so forth, that's not a recipe for success. The IRM formula needs to be viewed, in my professional opinion, holistically or on an integrated basis. In fact, conceptually, there is known overlap between some of the parameters. For example, there is an overlap between the determination of the X factor and earnings sharing mechanism to the extent you have both pieces as part of your IRM mechanism. There's also practical and empirical overlaps, or what I call interdependencies. For example, depending on your choice of inflation factor, the type of inflation indices you decide to use, there needs to be adjustments in how you think about and measure potential productivity. With that in mind, I'd like to move into some more concrete discussions. I hope I'm taking, I think, one of my first points here in the sense that any type of theoretical model consideration of IRM options needs to be grounded in the facts. And that's the objective of the next few slides. Here's a discussion point I heard earlier today. I thought it was a discussion of a little bit of nomenclature where we were talking about multi-year cost of service versus IRM. To some degree, and this introduces at least my bias to the nomenclature, I believe that one could characterize OPG's current cost of service regime is effectively a two-year form of IRM. Prices are determined based on two forward test years, and then they are fixed, and then it is OPG's job to go out and operate its business subject to those fixed price levels. And that's important to keep in mind. There's also other features that have incentive properties, as I mentioned lower down in my slide, within the current cost of service regime. The fact is that there is a volumetric or output-based tariff. There isn't a two-part tariff for current operations. There's a hydroelectric incentive mechanism. I'll spell it out because I don't know if I can keep saying him all the time. That also creates certain incentives that are consistent with policy objectives for the province. And there are also several deferral and variance accounts that exist as a result of regulatory requirements and OEB decisions. But part of the purpose of those accounts is to effectively manage incentives and consequences of certain actions for the utility. So that's kind of a review of the status quo from a regulatory side. Let's look at the future. Well, I think I would agree that the future is quite in flux for OPG's prescribed assets for the next 10 years or so. And I've tried to identify simply in terms of kind of graphical representation the nuclear and the hydroelectric prescribed assets in terms of installed capacity, and then I've asterisked those assets that are or those combinations of assets that are potentially subject to a non-steady state of future operations. Pickering A, for example, is expected, as well as Pickering B, to retire in the next 10 years. That's effectively more than 30% of capacity. There will be life extensions at Pickering B, currently planned. There is anticipation also of the Darlington refurbishment project in the next, starting in the next 5 years, that would also create long-term outages. Therefore, there'll be fluctuations not only in cost, but really in output. And to the extent that generation production is a form of output, that we measure productivity, where productivity is effectively defined as the quantity of output divided by the quantity of input, then the measures that we get from any historical studies of productivity are not going to be an appropriate basis for us to judge future productivity. Looking aside, though, and this is one of the points that I'm going to come to as part of my first set of recommendations and observations, I would say that we would strongly agree with Power Advisory in the sense that there appears to be a natural basis for thinking about IRM separately and distinctly for the nuclear and hydro operations. And I think that is one of the key takeaways from this slide, in the sense that there is probably more cost and output uncertainty for the nuclear fleet versus the hydroelectric fleet, at least for the next 10 years or so. So stepping into the recommendation sections, and I think we're still on time, Rusty. I'm going to start with a broad overview, and then I will follow into specific recommendations for each of the divisions, the hydroelectric and the nuclear, following very closely the same kind of pattern that Power Advisory had in their report and presentation today. We've also attempted in our discussions to keep the nomenclature, the numbering of the options the same, but I will apologize to the extent I've misinterpreted, potentially. I don't think I did, but feel free to jump in. And last comment before I step into the meat or the substance of this section is that we've got the additional appendices, which I won't go through today in presentation, but we welcome folks reviewing that at their own time and leisure. The headline, conclusion from our review of the Power Advisory Report is that we generally agree with a conceptual proposal primarily agree with what we read to be, in between the lines, the proposal for effectively separate IREM plans for nuclear and hydro. That conclusion, from our perspective, is based on a number of fact patterns. First and foremost, nuclear and hydro do have different businesses and are currently operated separately. They've also have had, in the past, different actual rates and targeted incentives set for the different businesses. So there's a history of already kind of individual treatment, if you will. Our understanding also is that to date in the cost of service process, cost allocation reviews have been conducted by the board, and there hasn't been any issues raised on current cost allocation methodologies deployed by OPG. And that gives us comfort that if we do treat them separately, that there aren't going to be these unintended consequences or big picture problems that might arise. I think the last point that we find very useful, and it may address some of the concerns I've heard this morning from stakeholders in the audience and on the phone, is that there may be also important lessons learned. This will be a first-generation IRM for the generation sector here in Ontario. And I think from the identification of kind of foundational facts, our recommendation is that IRM can be implemented for the hydroelectric fleet fairly quickly, and therefore we recommend that it is implemented first for the hydroelectric fleet for the sake of expediency and practicality. And then our secondary recommendation is that we also believe it's plausible institute a form of IRM for the nuclear fleet as well. But in terms of the schedule of events, there may be important practical lessons to be learned if, in fact, a first-generation IRM is implemented for the prescribed hydroelectric assets before it is then applied to the nuclear assets. Our second point is that we believe that the OPG business plans are a reasonable starting point, and I believe that is a conclusion that Power Advisory also made in their report. Not only is it reasonable, but I think it's also the proper baseline, because my understanding is it not only reflects management views on the costs of operation, but also builds in efficiency improvements that could be achievable in future operations. In that regard, I have concerns about plans that try to impose immediate stretch factors or consumer dividends, because in my opinion, they do create unintended consequences, and they may be, in fact, duplicative of other features of an IRM plan, like the earnings sharing mechanism. Power Advisory proposed a corporate earnings sharing mechanism, and we agree in principle, although I think at this point we haven't had the opportunity yet to investigate the specifics, and the devil is in the details, as you'll hear me say a few more times today. We recommend a symmetrical earnings sharing mechanism for the generation business, and in our opinion, that type of earnings sharing mechanism has features that are beneficial for both ratepayers, consumers, and for shareholders in OPG. However, we also, one of the concerns I always have is that the earnings sharing mechanism and the specific parameters that are associated with the dead bands, with the sharing percentages, those need to be put in the context of the overall IRM mechanism. So I can't give recommendations of the specificity of those values today, in the sense that they need to be designed side-by-side with the IRM mechanism. Power Advisory also in their report made recommendations on other elements of the IRM mechanism, for example, off-ramps, Z-factors, service quality performance indicators, and we find all that reasonable. They are part of the kind of best practices IRM price cap formula that one can apply, and we've applied them and made recommendations in other jurisdictions. However, what I would like to caution is that the devil's in the details with all those other elements and parameters, and we haven't gone through those yet, or at this point even presented our own independent recommendations on those specific elements. It'll be very important to make sure that they work well together and don't create conflicts in terms of incentives or undermining incentives in practice. I think it's quite important with any regulatory or policy level analysis to understand objectives. And I know Mitch and Bob have gone through the 8 objectives that they had in the report. We generally agree with those objectives, but we've recommended certain adjustments that have, for practical reasons, stemmed from my own experiences in applying price caps and various forms of PBR or IRM in other jurisdictions. And also, more locally, from my understanding or review of the ongoing RRFE process here in the province and some of the objectives and considerations that staff has raised in the straw man. So, for example, I think it's quite important to recognize the overall nature of government policy directives here in Ontario. And so one of the goals that I would like to add to the list is effectively the recognition that rates need to be aligned with policy directives. It becomes one of those constraints, the subject to, that you need to take into account. And hopefully the IRM mechanism has adaptability to be able to reflect that. Another goal I don't think necessarily is in conflict with the goals that Power Advisory has prepared is that of commercially reasonable rate of return. And I think the way that I'd like to formulate it, very similar to the question of financial integrity, is that under any regulatory scheme, as a regulated entity, OPG should have the opportunity to earn its allowed rate of return, reflective of its business risks. I then effectively bundled together many of the Power Advisory goals into one overarching category. And I think there's quite a lot of consistency given the discussions we had this morning here. I also believe that one of the objectives of an IRM mechanism, in fact, it should be an objective of any regulation, is to try to be efficient and to also preclude unintended consequences. While also being transparent and accountable. In effect, I believe that all of these different goals and objectives can be bundled in my view, in a general category where you have to be pragmatic in balancing theory and reality in terms of setting a regulatory regime. It goes back to, I think, a statement that I've definitely heard policymakers in Ontario and elsewhere state, which is that regulation is not only a science, it's an art form. There needs to be decisions made that may not necessarily come out of some scientific study or single study. And in that case, there's also a balancing mechanism between efficiency and reliability of service that needs to be maintained. I do think that one of the goals of an IRM framework should also be reduced regulatory costs. I think that was mentioned earlier, and I've added that to my list as well. And lastly, I think an important point that was raised in the RRFE straw man is one of long-term planning and stability. And that stability is not just from the perspective of customers, ratepayers, but also of investors, in the sense that this is a regulated industry, and part of the consideration of rate stability or instability does affect the commercially reasonable rate of return and business risks. So with that in mind, on slide 12, for those on the phone, I'd like to step through the recommendations on the hydroelectric portfolio. In summary, our recommendation is to incorporate a variation of the price cap approach for the hydroelectric portfolio. The reason I refer to this as a variation is that effectively it's building on an option that was discussed in the nuclear section by Power Advisory, but may have not necessarily been identified as a discrete option for hydroelectric of the six options that were laid out in the Power Advisory report. So we've labeled it H7. In effect, it is a price cap, so a variation on H5. But what we would like to propose is that it's more similar to the N2 concept on the nuclear side, which I understand to be really similar to what I've called the building block approach. We're effectively creating through a consultative or maybe a rate-making process a set of future prices, fixed prices, against which then OPG as a business would have to operate. I believe this is superior to what would be a more traditional price cap with a TFP-based approach to the X factor for a number of very pragmatic reasons. I understand that OEB in the past has been quite concerned with underinvestment in hydroelectric, and that as Power Advisory has identified, there's also concern with the maintenance of long-term asset value. And, of course, there's the question of lumpy capital investment that's been mentioned quite a few times this morning. So, effectively, in consideration of these pragmatic issues, I think that the building block approach is likely to be a more successful form of price cap regime for the hydroelectric portfolio because it is specifically adapting to those particular considerations. In addition, to the extent that there are policy directives from government and rate stability is a key objective of the board, the building block approach effectively deals with those issues as well. And lastly, I think, again, it mirrors a little bit the commentary we heard from earlier this morning from Mitch and Bob, to the extent that there is some symmetry or maybe some additional learning by doing, not just for OPG, but also for stakeholders and for the board as the regulator, the imposition of the H7 option on the hydroelectric portfolio could be quite valuable down the road to looking at a price cap option then for nuclear. In terms of additional features like HIM, hydroelectric incentive mechanism, SBG, surplus baseload generation, and other performance metrics, they could be quite positive, what I would call value adders to the overall IRM formula in theory. But I think additional analysis must be performed in order to understand how they practically fit together. One of my concerns is that the after-the-fact SBG reviews can't create unintended regulatory risks and consequences. It may be worthwhile to consider how the mechanism of these after-the-fact reviews could be streamlined so that it is more predictable and that the regulatory uncertainty is reduced. Moving on now, on the hydroelectric options, we've done something very similar with what I call moon diagrams instead of with numbers in terms of rating our options, and we've added in on slide 13, the H7 option that we've created, the price cap using building blocks. Effectively, I think the areas of difference, if you compare H7 versus H5, which is the traditional price cap using the TFP approach, I think the differences are going to lie in the second row. The building block approach, I think, provides a mechanism that does allow more directly for pragmatic considerations of reality versus theory. In addition, I also believe that the building block approach provides a direct rather than indirect mechanism by which policy directives given by government can be implemented. And lastly, although it doesn't appear here, there is the benefit, as I mentioned earlier, of learning by doing for the nuclear IRM. So moving on to nuclear now, we recommend that what I believe Power Advisory labeled as the N2 option for nuclear IRM. Generally, we believe that the N2 approach is plausible, is doable in effect for nuclear, although it may not be doable today because of the without a lot of bells and whistles to consider how you deal with deferral accounts regarding costs, fixed costs during periods of long-term outages and reduced production. the proposal for an N2 approach, which is effectively a price cap, doesn't obviate or doesn't reduce the need for productivity and performance analysis. Benchmarking studies, in our opinion, will still be important and critical because there still will need to be an assessment of OPG's performance for the future. And those productivity targets will be embedded into the revenue requirement and effectively into the projection of future production, which will in turn create that future price cap, the glide path that will serve as the multi-year form of IREM regulation for the nuclear fleet. I also think it's quite reasonable for new nuclear to be dealt with separately. In fact, I think that will be quite important that new nuclear be considered outside the realm of the existing nuclear fleet. The earnings sharing mechanism, again, in my opinion, is a very valuable add-on. It has attributes that are helpful for the regulated utility and for consumers. It smooths rates, and it also reduces the risk of what I would call unintended consequences and unscheduled regulatory interventions, and does so also in between generations of IREM. Down the road, it provides a much smoother trajectory over time. With that in mind, on slide 15, we again have the moon diagram comparative analysis of the various nuclear options, and I've highlighted in a light green N2, which is our recommended option, the price cap using building blocks. As you can see from the diagram, it is our professional opinion that the building blocks approach is more efficient, more effective at aligning rates with policy directives, at incorporating rate stability and reducing earnings volatility, as well as creating a pragmatic consideration of the theory and reality for promoting future efficiency. Depending on which options you look at, it also provides for a higher likelihood that OPG has that opportunity to earn a commercially reasonable rate of return that is commensurate with the business risks that it faces. You'll also notice in this graph that I have question marks for option N5, which is IREM for the DRP, in part because I think before we can actually judge it relative to other options, it's important to define it, and we haven't really defined it. What we've said is it's just an IREM. And there may be different mechanisms by which, in effect, new or refurbished nuclear is supported in the Ontario marketplace. With that, I conclude the presentation, and I would welcome any questions or discussion.
We have 15 minutes till we have our scheduled lunch break, but we also have time for after lunch for questions as well. So we'll start with the online people. Operator, are there any questions?
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 for any questions or comments. There are no questions. I'm sorry. We have a question from Larry Schwartz. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed the presentation, and it raises many detailed questions.
Excuse me, Larry. Can you speak up some? You're fading on us.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Maybe because I'm not using a speakerphone when I wish I were. I appreciated the presentation, and my question will be somewhat general, but I was intrigued by the reference to the general applicability or non-applicability of the idea of the steady state. And I wonder whether anything would change if we had a firm view on whether demand for electricity exogenously was going to be very high or very slow or perhaps even fall. I mean, would is it the general consensus that incentive regulation would be desirable regardless of those scenarios, or perhaps do the consultants have a view on what exogenous energy demand is going to be like and why the steady state paradigm may not be applicable?
So this is AJ from Money Economics International. There's a couple things here, and I think this gets to a little bit of the difference between how you might think about IRM for a wires business as opposed to thinking about it from the standpoint of a generation company. And so when we look at a generation company, we want to think about, and I'm speaking generally, I'm not talking about hydro or nuclear, but just generally, what we're looking for is to, within the construct of maintaining safety and compliance with applicable laws, we're looking to maximize or optimize generation relative to the capabilities of the underlying installed capacity. So the question of demand as a factor in the consideration for the design of an IRM for a generation facility is something that doesn't come into play the way it does for a wires company. Now, the one caveat there is that in thinking about the future needs of the overall system, that's going to drive thinking about capital expenditures that are looking to expand, refresh, and looking at life extension. I always like having a soundtrack. But that's the only area in which I would think about demand for electricity in the overall economy having an impact on these kinds of decisions. It really impacts whether you actually want to incentivize the company to invest in plans to expand productive capacity.
I would only add one thing onto AJ's in the sense that moving away from AJ's generic discussion of generation to the specificity of these assets that are prescribed assets for OPG, none of them generally would be considered assets that would be subject to the type of dispatch risk that of the wholesale market that would be potentially driven by demand levels. So in that case, they are agnostic, I guess, to actual demand conditions to some degree, although the issue of the hydro incentive mechanism and the SBG, the surplus baseload generation, does touch a little bit on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do you have a follow-up, Larry?
No, I don't, in part because I haven't thought this through very much myself.
Okay, well, you'll have an opportunity to send it in if you like.
Yeah.
We'll open it to the floor for questions. Jay?
Is there a report underlying this presentation?
No, not at this time.
Why not?
Well, I think primarily because we reviewed a report and then came up with our recommendations in slide format. That was the format of the product.
So your report is your slide presentation?
Yes.
When are we going to see it?
The slide presentation?
Yeah.
I believe it's available now. We've sent it through the board, so whenever they have the time to post it.
But we'll be posting the slide presentation later today.
Okay, why didn't we see it in advance so we could have intelligent questions?
Well, I think we were working on pretty much what I would call a short deadline for this presentation.
Another question from the floor? Julie
Gervin. Julie, could you just, again, sort of similar to the question I asked Mitch, is can you take me through, from a practical perspective, how your option for hydro would work, the building blocks approach?
Well, I think it would work from the perspective of starting with what I would call a cost-to-service baseline or the business plans that are created by OPG, where future operating and capital expenditure costs identified, future plans for maintenance outages and therefore production levels under normal water levels are identified, and the combination performance targets against those broad measures of costs as well as outputs is applied to create a future revenue requirement per unit of output. And effectively that future revenue requirement per unit of output, taking into account those productivity targets, be they on the unit of output in terms of availability factors or on specific categories of costs, as well as capital expenditure for purposes of maintaining the assets, those would be basically utilized to create a glide path for rates and define then effectively the rate escalation mechanism that would be applied over whatever would be deemed to be the term of the IRM plan.
Do you have a follow-up?
So the first step is really what we have today, which is cost of service.
Yes. The first step is to start with an expectation of cost.
Okay. And then what would happen in year two?
Well, and I think this does get a little bit back into the nomenclature issue. Effectively, I think maybe it was Jay who described it as a multi-year cost-to-service plan. In my mind, you could describe it as such, but
okay.
It's effectively also multi-year. Once you fix the rate, it becomes a multi-year price cap plan too. So it's a multi-year business plan, effectively, that looks at costs and production and then incorporates productivity targets, for example, improvements in production, as well as potentially improvements in or reductions effectively in costs, an efficient capital expenditure schedule, and converts those items, those building blocks, that's the name, into a forecast of an implied escalation mechanism.
Yeah, I guess I would see it, I think I understand, but really, as Jay was saying earlier, is a multi-year cost of service.
The reason I think it's not fair to call it cost of service mm-hmm. is because after it's fixed, it's no longer cost of service in the sense that OPG, unless it actually meets whatever the triggers are for an off-ramp, can't come back year two or year three and say my costs are higher. They have to live with the business with escalation mechanisms. So effectively, it's very similar, and this is why I mentioned a bit of the history of the UK. It is the RPI minus X, their formulation of a price cap, which creates incentives for OPG to do better than the implied costs that are part of that multi-year business plan.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, one more question from the floor, Norm.
Yeah, Norm Rubin for Energy Probe. I just want to basically get your take on the discussion I had with PA about adding some quality of service kinds of incentives, but specifically I'm most interested in some nuclear safety benchmarks as additional incentives on the nuclear side. I notice you have a lot more happy face moons for N2 than you do for N4, and I guess this technically gets us to N4, and I guess I would like to know whether that really makes you hostile or negative toward adding these kinds of adders, or if you can comment.
I would preface, I think AJ wants to answer this question, I would preface that this is our professional opinion about performance standards and specifically the safety question, and perhaps the company OPG will have their own views on this as well, but I would welcome you to ask them. But AJ, did you want to start off?
I think it's important to step back a minute and think about all the companies that do things that can kill people, right? And to think about the fact that we all operate within a legal framework that sets some basic minimum conditions for us to operate. Now, in the case of the nuclear industry, we have some very extensive criteria, but there are companies that operate in a competitive marketplace every day that are subject to significant safety issues, whether we talk about airlines or drug companies or chemical companies, where in the context of operating in the market, they certainly face, on the one hand, pressure to cut costs, but on the other hand, the basic minimum framework for them to exist is first and foremost to comply with safety. That doesn't go away with a focus on incentives. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind. Now, with that basic understanding, I think we can add that would we necessarily be opposed, first of all, to tracking performance that is better than what's required for the minimum standards? Not at all. The question of whether you want to allow, certainly our client would be happy to be able to earn more to exceed the standards that are set by the regulator. But whether as a matter of public policy we want to have customers pay more for that is something that would have to be explored in the context of both the regulatory construct and what the company was interested in.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't as curious about your approach to nuclear safety as I was to your approach to incentive regulatory mechanisms. And my question is, does your, you know, hostility is too strong a word, but does your negativity toward N4 compared to N2 indicate that adding some quality of service, I'll call them, incentives to an otherwise N2 or to your otherwise favorite incentive, does it hurt? Does it really turn you negative on the scheme? Would it be a mistake in England they took the electricity distributor and said you'll get a better return on equity if you don't disconnect as many poor people during the winter, and you'll make less money if that number goes up. I mean, there was a quality of service thing. There are things we want from our generator, whether it's nuclear safety benchmarks or something else. There may be things that we can convince a regulator are good things that don't show up in lower cost and lower rates and higher output. Is it bad to slide toward N4 in your view for some regulatory reason? And if so, what are the reasons?
So I'll give you two thoughts on that, and then Julia will continue, which is, I think, first of all, we really need to distinguish between the distribution sector and the generation sector in terms of the way in which we define the product that they deliver. And so when we're looking at a particular generation station, you know, ultimately, again, the product that we want is to maximize output and to make sure that we have a reasonable understanding that the plant will be available when we want it to be available. That is, that it's the plant is not down at a time when water is available, right? These kinds of things. And the mechanism that OPG operates under today already embeds within it a substantial amount of those incentives, given that it is volumetric. Now, the fact that it's volumetric poses some challenges for the company as well, that I'm sure that they will share with you. But Generally speaking, there are a number of what we might call incentives compatible characteristics from the way that the structure is already set up. Secondly, we really do need to be careful, as Julia has already mentioned, to make sure that we don't end up with a holiday tree, if you will, of incentives that we start having interaction problems. And so in terms of core objectives of simplicity and incentives compatibility, for a generation company, I think we need to be very, very careful as to what we add on to the incentives mechanism, because it starts to become a bit of a laundry list.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, that I think in theory, there probably isn't, I couldn't say as an economist that there's a problem with incorporating a policy goal. You know, the policy goal effectively has to be pragmatic. Trump's economic efficiency, may trump economic efficiency. But I think it's the devil, again, is in the details. You wouldn't want to be duplicative in compensation, and you wouldn't want to be punitive in any potential penalties as well, such that that it undermines other objectives we want in terms of a stable rate, stable earnings, reduced regulatory costs and uncertainties, and kind of the goal towards efficiency. So there may be choices that one actually makes once you start looking into the actual values, if you will.
I'm going to ask the operator to check to see if there are any questions from those that are online before we break for lunch. Operator?
Thank you. If you have a question, please press star 1. There are no questions registered at this time.
Okay.